people. This is street radio for unsung heroes. Riding in the Rego, trying to stay legal. My daughter found Nemo, I found the new primo. Yeah, you know how we do it for the people. And the struggle of the brothers and the folks, the lovers of the ropes. Experiment to discover hope, suffer for notes. The rougher I wrote, times was harder. Went from rock starter to the voice of a martyr. Why white folk focus on dogs and yoga? My people on the low end trying to ball and get over. Lyrics are like liquor for the fallen soldier. From the bounce to the house.
Well, welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines on KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web for the world at www.kpfk.org. I'd like to welcome Ajamu Baraka to the show. Ajamu is the executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network with over 250 member organizations working on the full spectrum of human rights issues. Welcome to the show, Ajamu.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we just heard from Chris Crum, who laid down kind of conditions to give us a look at what the situation is in the Gulf Coast 2 years post-Katrina and Rita. In talking and hearing you talk, I mean, one of the most glaring issues still is how many people are displaced throughout the U.S. and have not had a ability to return. And in one of your articles in Yes Magazine, you said this is the second largest internally displaced population in the Western Hemisphere. Talk about the situation and why you think this is one of the central challenges.
Well, I think it's one of the most egregious ongoing human rights situations that we have seen in this country. The very fact that 2 years after Katrina and Rita, we still have 250,000 or more people who are still displaced from the region is something that I think most people should be outraged about. But yet we continue with the situation, as Chris laid out in his report. We have still have 60,000 people living in trailers. We still have people who are dispersed throughout the entire country. And as you indicated in one of my pieces, this displaced population is, in fact, the second largest displaced population in this hemisphere, the first one being Colombia. So all of the issues that Chris shared with your audience a little while ago, all those issues would be and should have been addressed if the national authorities in this country adhere to the international principles that are supposed to guide a state's behavior when they have a displaced population like what we have here in this country. But, of course, they have failed to live up to those obligations.
Well, in terms of looking at what's going on in the Gulf Coast, I mean, there is, in my recent memory, no more better example, unfortunately, to really indicate what national oppression in the United States look like. So we're talking about something beyond racial oppression, the systematic oppression and exploitation of a people's. So regardless of your, you know, you could be a citizen, and the reality is your conditional relationship to the United States. So, I mean, one of the things that you've often talked about is trying to use the human rights framework within the UN and internally displaced people. Now, in different periods in history, we've seen people like try to evoke the UN. Malcolm X did that in terms of using the civil rights movement beyond the border of the states. But, I mean, in different instances, if we understand the role of national oppression, how do we use the human rights framework to really talk about the level of egregiousness in terms of whether you want to call it, like Eric does, the racist reenslavement complex or ethnic cleansing? How do we ensure that this is looking through it in the lens of how do we ensure that the most oppressed, and in this case, African Americans or black folks, have the right of return?
Well, I mean, we one of the things that distinguishes the kind of our approach to human rights work as opposed to the work that some of the more traditional groups are involved in is that we recognize that the struggle for human rights is, in fact, a struggle for power. That basically, if the people who are being directly impacted by these ongoing egregious violations are not in a position to be self-organized, to advance their interests, to build the power in order to transform relationships and transform structures and institutions, then we will always have human rights violations. So for us, this framework is a framework that we use as an instrument for social change. An instrument for building power, for changing consciousness. It is an instrument for liberation, basically. So while we will utilize UN structures to sharpen the contradictions, to point out the contradictions, to link up with our friends and allies, to put pressure on the U.S. government to adhere to its obligations. All that's important. But in the end, we still recognize that we have to build a powerful people's movement for democracy and for human rights. That's the only way we're going to be able to defend ourselves and to advance our interests. So we see this very much as part of a historic process, a process for building democracy in this country.
So, John, we talk about how we can, in terms of kind of hooks, in using the, if the folks displaced from Hurricane Katrina can be given internally displaced status, mm-hmm. what would that look like? Is it on the international level? How would it look like in terms of on the national level?
Well, see, the thing with the category of internally displaced persons, if you recall when Katrina first went down and there was this national discussion around what do we call these folks? You know, at first people were referring to people as refugees, and then that had sort of a racial connotation, and of course it wasn't really that accurate. And then we had to engage people and show them that basically what we had was a situation where people were internally displaced. And it wasn't just a semantical kind of thing. What that means is basically that there are guiding principles, there are guidelines that are supposed to provide a blueprint for how governments are supposed to relate to people who have been displaced, the kinds of rights that people have when they're displaced, the kinds of responsibilities that a government has to a displaced population. Now, this blueprint, they don't have the force of law necessarily, but they're supposed to be guidelines that states adhere to. Even the U.S. government, through USAID, was in the forefront of trying to impose these behavioral standards on other states. For example, they criticized the government of Sudan for not adhering to the guiding principles as it relates to what was happening in southern Sudan and Darfur. So we say that if those principles are adequate for the Sudan, they should be adequate to the U.S. And so we called on the U.S. government to have the same commitment to protecting the rights of people who have been displaced in this country as in other places. It also means that if the guiding principles are adhered to, it means that issues around participation would have been solved, because the guiding principles say very clearly that the communities most affected by displacement, the people displacement who have been displaced, that they have a right and a responsibility to be to have a voice in the reconstruction process. That never really happened. The whole discussion and controversy around voting would have been completely dealt with, because it says that if people are displaced, they have a right to participate politically, which means also voting. So when you are displaced out of Louisiana, you know, you have to travel back to Louisiana to participate in the elections. It says that basically the national government has a responsibility to ensure that the conditions are created to allow people to return back to their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the government would adhere to those principles, then the policies that were developed, that they came out of FEMA, then those policies would have looked entirely different, and the conditions would have been different by this point.
Well, you know, you have been on one of the forefront in the effort to try to apply the international human rights framework to domestic social justice advocacy, you know, starting with being the Southern Regional Director for Amnesty International, now with the U.S. Human Rights Network. Have you been able to see this framework in other spaces that have been able to give it some leverage?
Oh, yeah. I mean, across the country, people are redefining their work in human rights terms. And, I mean, people are rediscovering the lessons that people like Malcolm X had for us, you know, years ago, that basically we had to transcend the limitations of U.S. constitutionalism. We had to appeal to a higher set of values and principles. We had to have a different set of guidelines for our work. We had to see that our work was about social justice, and that the conditions and the issues we were facing here in this country were very similar to the same kinds of issues and conditions people face around the world. And therefore, then the human rights framework was an instrument that allowed us to link up with those other progressive forces throughout the entire world and to see ourselves in a way in which we saw the common interests we had with people around the world. So now I'm seeing a lot of change, and people are taking up this framework and understanding that this is a framework you use to demand rights, not going hat in hand and begging somebody for your rights, but to demand the fact that you have the right to live as a dignified human being, your communities have a right to self-determination, and that we have a right to build power to ensure that our rights are in fact protected.
Well, great, Ajahn Mubarakdas. So you're going to stay on. We're going to take a short break, and Kali Akuno from the People's Hurricane Relief Fund will be joining us. Stay tuned.